Welcome to the FTN Fantasy Baseball Podcast with your co-hosts Matthew Davis and Matt Kupferle.
And welcome to episode 27 of the FTN Fabcast. I'm Matthew Davis, and today is Wednesday, January 27th, and I'm joined as usual with my partner in crime, Matt Kupferle. Are you guys surviving the weather over there?
We are surviving, but barely. We got our first snowfall of winter, which is very late. It's kind of stopped now, but it is just, it's been nasty the last couple days. We got like probably 3 or 4 inches of rain the other day, which would have been a horrible snowstorm. So we're making it work, but kids got called off school, so it's a little bit hectic around the house, but excited to talk some baseball for sure.
Yeah, we're actually getting rain, which is really rare in California because I like to think of it as a desert similar to Arizona. But the projections are showing 3 to 7 inches of rain, which is like almost like a year worth all in today. So it's been very interesting. The winds are up to close to 30 miles an hour, and the rain has been nonstop since last night. And I'm enjoying it. I'm glad to be at home with a fire going and hanging out, ready to talk baseball with you and not be out in those elements, even though I do like the elements. So, yeah, let's jump into what's been going on in the MLB. And first, I guess we should start off with JT Realmuto. And he inked a 5-year deal with the Philadelphia Phillies, which I think most of us were pretty much expecting to do where he was going to land. I know most people doing their projections were kind of assuming that that's the ballpark lineup context that he would fall into. And that's what happened there. I don't want to get into the money and where it lands because it has no relevancy for us. But do you have any quick thoughts on him? Are you into the closer market in the late second, early third round? And then any impact that it has for Philadelphia?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, that I think that Philly lineup, most importantly, it was a little bit thin, in my opinion. It's kind of like some of these lineups that we're seeing. It was pretty top-heavy. And I think it gets into some weird spots at the back half of the lineup. I think obviously this lengthens that a bit. You know, him going to Philly, great signing for them. You know, I think he's, you know, one that you can count on. I did actually see an interesting thread I wanted to get your thoughts on. Because, you know, I think we've got, you know, our friends in the industry, especially, you know, Toby, aka Batflip Crazy, and some others are emulating, you know, some of his style. And one of his big things is really locking in, you know, JTR at that catcher spot. As I look at it, I'm really having a hard time spending that kind of draft capital that early. Now, it doesn't mean that there's not a right spot to take him. I just, when you say late second, early third, for me, Matthew, that feels very early. I struggle that there's not other ways, especially with the way pitching is already getting pushed up. I've heard you talk about it on a couple of different podcasts, and obviously that's going to continue to get inflated a bit. It makes me nervous spending a pick that early on a guy like JTR, as good as he is. So I was curious to get your thoughts. I know you've espoused kind of a late catcher strategy and you've been really good at it, but what do you think? Are you a JTR's worth it kind of a guy, or are you not bought in so much?
I have one share already, and I drafted that in the early third round of a draft championship league. And that was early December. And the more I got to think about it and talking to other people, with this being a full season, we don't 100% know if there's going to be a DH, but let's just say there is a DH. That will help definitely with his plate appearances and whatnot. Mm-hmm. But not many people like to give credit to Mike Masato, a.k.a. MTM, at the Godfather NFBC on Twitter. He's mentioned, you know, investing this type of money in catchers, and it really hasn't been sustainable in the long term. You know, people jumped in on, you know, Gary Sanchez when that was a thing, and that really shit the bed. And he does bring up some good points in context with what happens when a foul ball goes wrong and, yeah, you know, it hits off somewhere that you weren't expecting, his wrist or wherever. And it just takes one wrong dinger and he's on the IL. And yep, then you've already lost 2 weeks, and then the replacement value for that position is just brutal. And now you leave yourself kind of behind when, yep, those other players being drafted at that point could have been Bo Bichette or whatever hitter that you're, you know, really, mm-hmm, liking there. It could be, you know, Rafael Devers or Manny Machado, yeah, Kyle Tucker, whoever it may be. I think that their injury risk is much less, and there is data and statistics on injury percentages per position, and pitchers and catchers are by far the most susceptible to getting injured. And so investing early on somebody like that, and with the statistics that he provides, don't get me wrong, the 25-plus home runs, 80-plus RBI, 80-plus runs, you know, 160-plus, 170-plus in counting stats, plus maybe 10 stolen bases we're hoping for.
Sure.
And a batting average that isn't going to kill you, but it's not a 300 batting average. So I'm not sure what he's really – he doesn't push the needle in one specific category. I did have him in a main event last season, and I was all for it in a shortened season because – with the DH in the NL and it being a shortened season, I was willing to take that risk with it being, you know, a little less than or a little more than a third of the season. The injury risk, I guess, would be shortened, I suppose. And it did work out. But in a full season for a catcher, it is extremely, extremely tough for them to return that profit on where you're investing, especially with him. It's going to be tough for me to buy back in the early third this year, I think.
I think that's all totally fair, especially when I look at that position, you know, guys that are going significantly later. I'm not the biggest Salvador Perez guy. I can understand why, and he, you know, he should rack up a lot of counting categories. But going after those guys, I mean, Will Smith, Yasmani Grandal, Travis d'Arnaud, Christian Vasquez. I mean, there's just you're not required to spend that kind of draft capital to get return on investment. And you've got guys like you highlighted Gary Sanchez. I think folks that drafted Mitch Garver last year were pretty disappointed at the end of the day. You know, there's a lot of risk there. So I'm with you. I'm in lockstep with you there.
I have a tweet saved in my draft that I'm ready to fire off at an optimal time. And I just want anybody that has drafted Salvador Perez at his current cost to show themselves and please really explain why
we're talking to you directly right now.
He's done it. Yeah, he's done it. I've seen other sharp people in the industry do it as well. His current NFBC ADP is 78 with a min of 68 and a max of 105. You're taking Salvador Perez over Michael Conforto. Pitchers like Framber Valdez, Jose Berrios. I don't know. I don't get it. I really, 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 really do not get it. Wilson Ramos just signed with the fucking Detroit Tigers. Like, can he not put up similar numbers to Salvador Perez? And he's going to get burned there. So I don't understand. And you can get Wilson Ramos 28 rounds later.
Yep.
Or whatever. Show yourselves. I'll tweet that out too, but please, like, I'm being serious, not just trying to sound like an asshole, even though I am. Show yourselves and explain to me why you are willing to spend an early sixth round or a late fifth round pick on Salvador Perez.
I like that.
That seems ludicrous to me. Yeah. Moving on. The cheap, I guess we can still call them the Cleveland Indians. They have spent a one-year deal bringing back Cesar Hernandez. Even before this deal, I had been tweeting out that I was kind of concerned about where Andrés Giménez was being drafted. Mm-hmm. In early December when I was first drafting, his ADP was well past the 20th round, and then he got traded to Cleveland. Everybody started to hype up the stolen base potential, and his ADP is now up to 158 with a min of 119. And I've seen recent reports that he could potentially be starting the season off in the minor leagues with Amed Rosario and Cesar Hernandez playing up the middle. And if that does happen, how are you supposed to be evaluating Andrés Giménez? I mean, you can't possibly be spending a 10th or 11th round pick on somebody that could be spending the majority of the season in the minors, or at least starting there. And then the team context there is dog shit. And then he might hit 8th or 9th. So what are we doing?
Yeah, I mean, I think he's going to turn himself only into kind of a draft champion style format where you're going to wait and hold off on him. You know, I think the speculation comes from there was a lot of folks that were just wondering. I mean, it feels like Andrés Giménez came up last year mostly out of need. There was a lot going on with that Mets team. And so honestly, I mean, the guy has accrued 1 year of service time, but if they send him back down, they're just delaying his free agency yet again. If they don't think he's ready, there's no reason for them to bring it up if they think he's going to be part of their major league team. I mean, the thing that we know is the Indians are going to do whatever they can to spend as little as possible. I think their payroll currently, as it sits today, even with Jose Ramirez on the team, is under $30 million as a team, which is just a little bit mind-boggling to me. But they're not going to blow things out of the water. I mean, I think people get excited about him, Matthew, because he's eligible at second, third, and short over at the NFBC. His average pick since December 1st is 182.66. But to me, even at 182.66, I don't know that I'm enjoying or drafting, you know, him over somebody like Nick Madrigal, Chris Taylor, David Fletcher. I mean, those guys, I think, have jobs. I don't know why I would take a guy like Jimenez over any of them. And, I mean, even there's guys later. Like, I think Mauricio Dubon has a nice hit tool that could play. I think Ty France is going to get some run at second base. It obviously depends on what team you've constructed, because I think Jimenez is a different player than those guys. All in all, it's probably a stay away for me at this point.
If there's desperation, you know, seeping in and you need stolen bases, I'm starting to see Victor Robles, and I know that he's a hot topic if you either, you know, you're in on him or you're out on him, but Byron Buxton and Victor Robles were getting drafted really close to Andrés Giménez before the chatter of Cesar Hernández being signed back to Cleveland. And it just goes to show you that, well, he was a rookie last year. He had 8 stolen bases in 50 games or whatever. And now he's with Cleveland and they have nobody. So he's going to play every day and he's going to steal 30 plus bases or whatever these people are thinking. Remember, look back. What were people saying? I've seen Byron Buxton drafted in the 3rd round of main events, and now he's being drafted close to Andrés Giménez because he was traded to the Cleveland Indians. It makes no fucking sense to me. And Victor Robles isn't dead yet either. I think that there's still room for growth there, and he's going to steal more bases than Andrés Giménez one way or another regardless. So I don't know. I think that sometimes when people get traded or even signed at this time of the season, that ADP just takes a huge skyrocket up, regardless of what they're doing or providing, where they're playing, where they're hitting in a lineup. It just goes up. The cost goes up. Anytime somebody signs, it goes up. I mean, Victor Robles is in a good lineup right now in Washington, and he's not getting traded anywhere. But if he was traded to, the Cleveland Indians, his ADP would go up. Why?
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
There's been a lot of talk lately about Masahiro Tanaka and his tenure in America, and I think that time has come. Unfortunately, I've always been a big fan of him and his game that he brought to the States. It sounds like he's going to be signing a 1-year deal with Japan. Is that correct?
That's right.
Okay. Yep. Okay. So I just wanted to mention that as, you know, erase him off your draft boards if you are in a draft champions and you're taking a late round flyer. And then on top of that, I kind of think that the bummer part of this, it just goes to show you the state of economics when it comes to Major League Baseball right now and how many teams are willing to spend a little bit of money. Everybody needs pitching depth. Everybody needs another starting pitcher, regardless of, you know, the quality of innings pitch that Tanaka was going to give. I think that it's a huge bummer, and it's some shade on the economics for baseball. So
yeah,
kind of wanted to bring that up. I think that that signing in Japan, you know, kind of correlates with where we're at and in the economy with baseball. But there's been a lot of talk in drafts. We're going to talk some draft strategy, and we're going to mention or kind of bring up a lot of hypothetical situations that you could potentially be in when it comes to a 15-team draft. And there's been a lot of coach speak about, you know, starting with the pocket aces. We've seen that, and now there's the full house method that's being thrown out, and that's 3 starting pitchers in the first 5. You might not necessarily have that plan of attack, but we're going to start with just all sorts of different scenarios. And I want to start with, what if you are drafting in the first part of the draft? You have the first or second pick, and you are adamant on becoming a heavy starting pitcher focused team, whether that's starting with Gerrit Cole, and then you're wanting another starting pitcher in your second or third. You want another second SP to pair with Cole before you leave that turn in the 3rd round. So let's say you start first or second and get Gerrit Cole, but then you're in a league, which I was just in the Battle of the Podcast League, and it felt very similar to how starting pitching is going to be pushed up this year. And by the time it got back to the team 2 and he had Gerrit Cole, the next starting pitcher available was Zach Gallen and Clayton Kershaw. Now, if your plan is to take 2 SPs no matter what, and those weren't the SPs that you were planning on, well, let's say Woodruff, what do you do, Matt? Are you going to continue to corner or pressure yourself to just take whatever next SP is available on your board? Or are you going to try and pivot? Because that's the first part of this whole puzzle.
Yeah. Yeah, I think in that particular instance, it's really hard to execute that strategy. You know, I think if you're picking that early, and you really marry yourself to the concept or the idea that you are simply going to take that next starting pitcher, I think it can be a little bit nervous. Now, I think that it just goes to show, you know, whatever is available, you got to kind of pivot and be available. Now, that being said, I think if you're willing to dive in there, I think that really addresses your strategy. Now, I also think, you know, I heard you use the term pocket aces or a full house strategy. And I think some people are doing that. Now, what's interesting to me is, so when in that strategy, right, obviously you're probably focusing on hitters after that point in time. But to me, it's when are you spending draft capital on that SP4 or SP3 in that scenario? Because I feel like I saw some drafts, Matthew, where, and maybe it was the Battle of the Podcast or it may have been something different, where somebody started their draft off, and I'm guilty of this too. I've done it before, so I'm not casting a stone at a glass house. I've done it, and I learned from it. Where you draft a Gerrit Cole super early, and then you get the vibe, okay, well, I can go away from starting pitching right now. I don't like that approach. I think if you're going to spend the equity, you need to back up the equity with additional volume. So I think if you're going that route, I think you got to spend again. I think it's more than okay to spend a second round pick. Then I do really think you have to focus on hitting at least for the next couple of picks, because you're already, you know, as teams are building that offense out, you're really starting at a deficit. So I don't have a problem. I try not to get too locked into any one strategy. But I think at that point, you're really going to have to start thinking about going hitter heavy for the next several picks. But I don't think that means you can ignore it until, say, you know, round 10, round 11, round 12. You really got to get honed in on where you want to go with that pick, because I think you got to supplement it more. I've seen it play out for myself where I actually did that and it didn't work out for me. So how about you? Have you ever either tried to do something like that, or you went pitcher really early, and what did you do? How did you fill that staff out next? Did you piggyback it, or did you wait? What worked best for you?
I always want to, but that doesn't mean that Goose has to be, you know, second or third round draft capital. In regards to a couple of those things, so in that Battle of the Podcast League, Toby, he went Yu Darvish and then Aaron Nola, but didn't take his third pitcher until the 13th round, and that was the end of the 13th round. And that's not sprinkling enough of yellow in between there, and I have a huge problem with that, to be honest. And I don't care if Yu Darvish and Aaron Nola finished first and second in the NL Cy Young. I still think that you're still going to have issues when you don't address it until the 13th yeah. round with Drew Smyly.
Yeah.
And then when you have Gerrit Cole, you could go hitter, hitter, hitter even, and then, you know, go with your SP2 in the fifth round. I'm completely fine with that. I'm fine starting Gerrit Cole with Carlos Carrasco or Kyle Hendricks or Jose Berrios or one of those guys that I think that they're, you know, going to be plenty fine as an SP2. And you're not crippling a lot of your hitting. And now there are teams in this Battle of the Podcast draft that did a very, very well job. I'd like to point out Jake Halusker and Dave McDonald. They were Team 10. They drafted right before me. And after their first five picks, they did have three starting pitchers with only two hitters. But the two hitters that they took were just phenomenal, in my opinion. And they started with Trevor Story. Then they backed that up with Jack Flaherty and Zach Plesac. And now I'm not as high as them or anywhere near as high as them when it comes to Zach Plesac. However, if you did the flip side of things and said, hey, they drafted Randy Arozarena in the third and Zach Plesac in the fourth, it's the same fucking thing and it comes out the same, but people look at it differently because of where they're being drafted. So on the outside looking in, when you get the combination of Trevor Story and Randy Arozarena paired with Jack Flaherty, Zach Plesac, and Kyle Hendricks, I think that is just a very well-rounded start to a full house approach, if you want to call it that, with the three SPs in the first five. So I think when doing that, you've got to get specific types of hitters, and they did that. That's power speed, you know, no huge liability in batting average from what we know with Randy Arozarena. And then there's other teams that kind of went in a similar approach, but in a different manner. So going hitter first and then going two pitchers and then another hitter, but you still have a full house approach. But it was just a little bit of a different approach in when they started that. So going, let's say, Team 15, Michael Govier went Christian Yelich, Walker Buehler, Blake Snell, then Starling Marte, and then his third starting pitcher to fill that house was Dylan Bundy. I don't know if there's a perfect formula or potion to be said, but it goes to the fact of showing, I think all of these approaches depend on where you're drafting. And yep. If you're in a certain situation and you go in saying, I want the full house approach, I want pocket aces, or I think that you could cause yourself to be in trouble, because then you're placing over, you're overcapitalizing your draft investment, and then you're now behind the eight ball. Yeah, and then you're behind the eight ball. So one of the things that Matt Williams and I discussed on the Turn 2 podcast, we both agreed that the middle spot was somewhere that we both felt comfortable and optimal drafting at, because you can kind of take whatever approach that you want to bring to that draft. And it seems like you're going to be able to, you know, put together that roster construction however you want. So if you're drafting 7th, 8th in a 15-team league, it feels pretty certain that you aren't going to miss out on your second pocket ace if that's what you want to do. Or you're not going to miss out on your third starting pitcher in the 4th or 5th round. And those two hitters, if you want to go full house, are going to be pretty damn good. If you're selecting the right hitters, though, of course, and if you're selecting the right combination of pitchers, because like I've said in the past, it is extremely difficult to select one starting pitcher that has a full successful season and then pairing him and having that combination of both being fully healthy and fully successful. The combination and probability of both of them doing that is extremely difficult. Now you want to throw in a third starting pitcher to have this full house method so you could be ahead of the curve when it comes to starting pitching. Topple on that third starting pitcher and now have him stay healthy and have his quality of innings pitched and workload be successful. That is a lot to ask for. The injury susceptibility is increased at the position, the volatility and everything that comes with it is extremely, extremely difficult. So just hitting on both of your pocket aces is really hard. Now pairing a third and hoping all three hit, I don't know, man. I think it's too rich for me. I do not think that I can go down that road. It's yet to be seen. I have not done that yet in a full 15-team league. There are too many good hitters that are now falling, in my opinion, in drafts, and I just simply cannot ignore that. And I'm not one. I've heard a lot of chatter lately. I don't like any starting pitcher that's going from rounds 9 through 14. I don't like them. Bullshit. There's plenty of starting pitchers to like round 9 through 14. You're fucking looking at things wrong then. I just think that people are being very lazy because they saw a shortened season and saw a few pitchers extremely explode. And then we saw pitchers that had really bad numbers. Ryan Bloomfield from Baseball HQ, he's an editor over there, does the awesome Bloom boards, had a cool board, a couple boards come up of pitchers that had one great start. And if you remove it, or if on the opposite side, if a pitcher had one bad start and you removed it, and it just goes to show you how insane that shortened season was. If one start is removed, some of these pitchers look like completely different performers. So I don't think that I'm going to be able to go down that road. Pick from the middle, go about the plan of attack that you want. But I tread with caution when investing too much in starting pitchers, man, that early. I think that you're asking for a lot, and all of them need a hit. What happens if, let's take a pairing, Buehler and Snell. What if one of them, right, and both of them were kind of, I don't think we're confident in either going 200-plus innings. So how do you back that? I don't know. I'm insecure right now with that. I think the pitching market's just gotten too aggressive. I think that it's overcorrected itself.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that, you know, I've heard Toby talk about it a lot, and I think you're really banking on, I think just like anything, right? You're, when I think about drafting early, and I think about Matthew, as we talked this time last year, as we got the podcast started, you know, we really thought about how things worked and didn't work, right? Overall, what were your hits and what were your misses? And I think back on, you know, some of my early, you know, OC teams that I was in, 750 draft in Vegas. And, you know, I think the biggest thing is, and you'll hear people say it all the time, and I think it's even more true with what you're saying, or and to piggyback off what you're saying, is that you really are trying to build your floor early in the draft. And you're hoping that you take some guys later that explode, right? I think the biggest thing is when we get too risky or we make too many reaches early and those explode, and you're just getting – you're banking on, you know, the guys that – are putting up 80 runs and 80 RBIs. Hopefully it's more than that, obviously. And if you draft a guy that gets hurt, you're fighting maybe an 80, 90, 100 run deficit right off the bat, right? Now let's pivot that to pitching. I think what you're saying is, and what makes total sense is, it's a position, just like catcher, that's extremely volatile and prone to injury. So if you take that one step further, I think investing in pitching – and the market dictates that you have to steer into the skid with this one. But the more times you repeat that, you are drafting at a position that clearly has a high level of volatility, that has an extreme miss rate. I think if anybody's gotten the Baseball Forecaster in 2021, there's a great article by the team there that showed, I think, the amount of pitchers that repeat their success year over year. And the starting pitcher position, as you would expect, is extremely volatile from that perspective. So I think when you add all those things up, to your point, you can hit home runs there. And if you nail those pitchers, man, you are at a super competitive advantage, probably not only in your league, but if there's an overall format, you're in a great spot too. But I think if you look at the teams that fare really well in their league and also in the overall, it's probably not the people that hit on their, you know, they didn't take three pitchers in the beginning. What really spurred them to the top of the leaderboard was the picks that were made in rounds 10 to 20 or rounds 10 to 30, right? It's those
right.
late
and that's
round
where people
picks.
Are saying, I don't like, yeah. And then right now it's, I don't like them. I don't like them. Like it's Aaron Civale, Herman Marquez, Dustin May, or whoever you're into. It's those guys that are going to support. Marcus Stroman, I think, could be very viable this year in supporting, you know, as an SP4 in a rotation. And that's where you hold your legs up and, you know, you keep infrastructure strong. I think that it just becomes really hard to bank on having three starting pitchers all stay healthy, all have their performances as you're projecting, and then to be able to hit, which last year in the shortened season, we saw it. We saw the Will Myers and the Alex Verdugo and the Trent Grisham and the Teoscar Hernandez. It all worked. It all worked. I get it. It all fucking worked. It was a perfect time and place. It fucking worked. It was a short season. I'm not buying into it.
Yeah.
I'm not sold. I've got to ask you though. So
let me ask you this. In that, let's say you're still going down that path. When are you taking a closer if you've invested all that draft capital early in pitching?
I'll tell you right now, I really want to pair Nick Anderson and Diego Castillo for one, and then I'd kind of like to do that with another team and move on.
So you're definitely not investing early.
I want a majority of the piece of the pie with high-skill relievers that don't have a certain role in air quotes that are being inflated in drafts. Because they are said closer,
right.
I'd rather just have two guys like that that I know are getting a large chunk of the pie that have better skills and are going to give me good ratios with high strikeout rates.
Okay.
And that to just keep it simple there, that's exactly how I'm attacking it.
So you're definitely not investing in the Hendricks, Hader, Diaz, Karinchak, Chapman crew that's going before pick 100?
No, thanks.
No.
Pass.
I get it.
Pass. Where they're going, Kenley Jansen, Edwin Diaz, now Kirby Yates. You're giving up a lot in the seventh or eighth round. So example, James Karinchak, are we 100% certain that he's the closer?
No.
Okay. He's going in the seventh round, sometimes the eighth round.
Yeah.
Nick Anderson and Devin Williams were going in the 11th and 12th round. Now in 15 team leagues. Now I'm seeing 13th round, 14th round, 15th round. Seems like every single DC or 15 team that I join, they continuously drop another round, whereas James Karinchak just stays stapled. What's the difference between James Karinchak Devin Williams and Nick Anderson. I have no fucking clue.
Well, I think the scary part
they're all great from a skills standpoint, right?
Yeah. I think the scary part for Grinchak to me is super high walk rate. And what financial incentive do the Indians have to let him close so that the closer he gets to be ARB eligible, he gets a huge number? I mean, they just won't do that, I don't think. So
yeah, that's a great point. And oh man, I
think the skills are fantastic.
That's a big highlight. Yes, agree. I was a big fanboy of Karinchak last year, yeah. And had him on a couple Emmys, and I believe he was on a winning main event team, but you can't do that. You can't just, this guy, he's the closer. We don't know that, especially with the ARB stuff that you just mentioned, and then completely dismiss and ignore Devin Williams and Nick Anderson. I agree for the most part. You draft role over skill when it comes to reliever, but
yeah,
I think that there is a lot of mistakes being made now, at least, because if you ask anybody, there's only 5 to maybe 8 teams, so less than a third of the teams have a certain closer in that role. So what are you doing drafting a role right now for 20 plus teams? You're not. You should be drafting the skills.
Yeah, I hear you. And I think people want to have that investable closer, so I get it. But man, that's a volatile position. If there's one guy that I was going to hang my hat on, it would probably be Hendricks, probably, but still volatility there for sure. So I think we're in the same spot.
Yeah, I mean, the problem with that, though, is the draft capital. I mean, yeah, sure, you're getting the number one closer on a great team, and he just got paid, and he has La Russa. He's going to burn him into the ground until his skin wears thin on his elbow, but shit happens, right? I mean, we would have said the same thing about Edwin Diaz and Blake Treinen and Kenley Jansen, and then we were saying it about Craig Kimbrell and, you know, whoever else, right? Every year we say that. And this year it's Liam Hendricks. Yep. It's going to be very interesting to see the final end of year results of 2021 Liam Hendricks, because what everyone's guessing and saying, that's fine. It's all fine and dandy and makes sense. But in reality, you still are investing a fourth round pick in a guy throwing 60 to 70 innings in a volatile spot.
Yeah, for sure.
It's tough.
For sure.
Okay. I wanted to ask you though, before we move out of the draft strategies and where you're picking from and how do you pivot and whatnot. If you are picking from the middle, and like I said, we feel like that's kind of a spot at the dinner table where you're able to just draft however you want. We can pick whatever team we want, right? It's not that easy. But if you were able to be given that spot and you could start your first five off in any sort of roster construction, how are you building that team? Now, I know I'm going to cheat a little bit before letting you start. Okay. Now, I know that you're very high, which sounds fucking crazy because the consensus isn't that high, but I know that you are still in love and have a lot of, you're smitten for Mike Trout, which sounds, I guess it's not crazy, but,
it does sound crazy to say. It does. Yeah.
That's not where everyone is itching when they have that, when they get their KDS rolled out and they get the 8th pick in the middle of the draft. I don't think many people are saying, I'm going Mike Trout and I'm building from there. So I'm going to put you in a corner and I'm going to say you got the 8th pick and you did go Mike Trout. I'm not letting you have anybody else but Mike Trout. Okay. Now you have four picks, and you know, you can kind of look at a draft board or ADP or just kind of give a lazy approach to how are you building off of starting with an outfielder? Because we've also heard people don't like to start outfield early because of the position so deep. That's conversation for another day. But so you start with an outfielder.
Yeah.
How are we building this team in the next four rounds?
Yeah. So part of my Mike Trout love is I'm penciling him in my projections, and I'm curious to see. I know Matthew, you do a great job with your projections where you have him. I think Mike Trout's a 40-10 guy this year, so I'm excited about what he can do, and I think he's in a great spot. But let's say I get lucky enough, because I like Mike Trout a lot. I think he's 100 to 110 runs in RBIs, homers, average, the whole kit and caboodle. I'm probably going starting pitcher with my second pick. I think I've made it known on Twitter, but if people haven't seen it, you know, I like you. To me, Yu Darvish and Lucas Giolito are my 3 and 4 this year, behind Cole and DeGrom. I think there's some regression coming with Shane Bieber, who I had a lot of. And maybe I'm just dead wrong on Trevor Bauer. Maybe I'm just going to own him in the wrong year every year. But I'm probably going with one of those two guys in a 12-team format, probably in a 15 as well. The only thing, and I really do believe, well, Matt,
real quick. So we're going to base this. We're basing this off 15 teams.
15.
And I'm also I'm gonna keep putting you in a tight corner. Sometimes I'm gonna budge in and
so I'm at 8 and like 22 and make this then. Tough.
So
right?
Darvish, all those guys, Darvish, Bauer, Giolito, Buehler, Nola, Castillo are all gone. You would be left with, after Mike Trout, Jack Flaherty, Max Scherzer, Brandon Woodruff, or Clayton Kershaw. Are you still going pitcher or do you go hitter?
Is Bryce Harper available?
He is.
That's where it gets really tricky for me. I really like Bryce Harper, even in an NFBC format where, you know, maybe his average is in the 260 to 270s. And I know it's outfield, which I personally think there is depth in the outfield. There's a lot of guys I like after pick 200. I am probably mulling over three players at that point. It's Bryce Harper.
That's where – go ahead, sorry.
No, I was going to say it's Bryce Harper, it's Bo Bichette, and for me, I am probably picking between – it's probably Brandon Woodruff, but I could make an argument. I think that it's Clayton Kershaw too, because I think that the depth and the quality of the 160 innings he'll give you is what I'm penciling in. And I can build out that way.
Okay. So that's a great spot to kind of lay another bookmark. So you have Trout and you just mentioned the four players that you're interested in, two of which were pitchers, Woodruff and Kershaw. The other two were hitters.
Yep.
Harper and Bichette.
Yep.
When you decide to click hitter or pitcher, this is now already going to set a major tone and dictate the roster construction that you put together. Now, you might say Woodruff and Kershaw, that's a little early, a little too rich for my blood, but if you don't go with them there, they're gone.
Yeah.
Now, and then also, so let's say you do go Harper or Bichette, whatever, they're both fine. You have in the third round, now we've seen right after Harper or Bichette, Flaherty, Scherzer, Woodruff, Kershaw, Gallen, Snell, Maeda, Glasnow are all gone. Are you willing to spend a third-round pick on Plesac, Lynn, Burns, Carrasco? That's where you're at already. It dries up so quick. Yeah. Now what do you do?
Yeah, and when I look at it that way, that's typically, Matthew, what pivots me to a second-round pitcher versus waiting, because really the only guy that I see there that's viable in my mind is Lance Lynn from an anchor perspective. You know, I was big on that Lance Lynn regression was coming and it bit him in the ass in the very last start of the season. But really, I mean, he had a phenomenal year. You know, I think moving from Globe Life Park to, I think it's called Guaranteed Rate now in Chicago, it won't help his fly ball tendencies. But what I do think will help is team context. I think he's going to win a ton of games. And I think Lance Lynn's just really freaking good and underrated a bit to an extent. So if I go hitter, and I love where you're going with this, I probably have to go Lance Lynn. I love the upside that Corbin Burns has, but for me, it goes back to what I said earlier. I am not drafting for home runs this early. I'm drafting for stability. And so that shapes me to be going Lance Lynn. That could be a huge mistake, but even if you say Tyler Glasnow is available, I'm not touching Tyler Glasnow. He's a two-pitch pitcher. There's too much volatility in the innings work. I could be so far behind from a pitching perspective if I don't go there. I don't know that Zach Plesac is a guy I want to plant my flag as my ace. So I'm going with Lance Lynn there. And then to flip that on its head, the dialogue of where you're going, that's ultimately probably why my draft strategy isn't hitter. As much as I like those guys, I'm probably going hitter, starting pitcher. But you're right. You have to think of it that way, because now the farther I go into that draft, it's thin, the herd is thinning out for sure. You are 100% right.
And every pick you make, you're digging your own hole, regardless of if it's a good hole or a bad hole. You're still digging. You know, one thing I will mention about Lynn, and this season is going to be a lot of fun. I think 2020 was a lot easier to predict than 2021. And Lance Lynn is going to be a volume monster. And I know I've heard it, you know, from you and from plenty of other analysts in the industry about the volume and racking up the wins. Wins are really hard to predict. We haven't seen Jacob deGrom rack up X amount of wins in so many years, and he's much better than Lynn. So I like to throw that statistic out.
I get it.
And then when you look at a volume monster, if he's hurting you in ratios, only giving you the high strikeouts because of the volume.
Yeah.
Now I think that you're in trouble a little bit. And yeah. We've seen Lynn's whips. They're not the most impressive. Absolutely. And I don't know. Sometimes volume can be bad volume. And I think and I've discussed this on a couple of other podcasts, where I might be more risk adverse, not when it comes to injuries. Not that I'm saying I'm in on Blake Snell or, you know, somebody else, like Yu Darvish or whoever that's had a little bit of an injury past or some concerns in my mind, at least. I don't think that I'm going to be too concerned about volume, and I'm going to be focused more on the quality per innings pitch. So, you know, later on in drafts, I've mentioned this already, but I'll keep mentioning it. Guys like Dustin May, Julio Urias, Tony Gonsolin, yes, they're all Dodgers, but even Marcus Stroman, even Nate Eovaldi, so guys like that, I think that they can be very valuable and viable in this season because they're going to give you good innings. At least I think they're going to give you good innings. And the draft capital just isn't as extreme. But when you're looking at a third-round pick, and I'm telling you, dude, Lance Lynn will be a third-round pick by the time main events come. Lance Lynn will be jumbled in there. You'll see somebody like Eloy Jimenez, Anthony Rendon, Luis Robert, Whit Merrifield. Those guys, Corey Seager, those guys are going to fall to the fourth round. And you're going to see everybody up to, I believe, Lance Lynn will be in the third round. So you're going to have quite a few starting pitchers going in that first 45 picks.
Yeah, and I really like a scenario where Lance Lynn is my number two.
Sure.
If I went Trout, Kershaw.
See, that's you'd have to go. But now, Kershaw, mid-second, Lynn, mid-third, I think that you've overspent on both. And I'm literally the billboard of fanboy. You've kind of reached a little there. You've reached a little there. Now you're waiting for your second hitter in the fourth. I don't know. I just think that's makes the eighth spot tricky, right? Because we were just mentioning how we feel comfortable eating at the dinner table from that spot. But now, maybe Mike Trout isn't the spot to go. If Jacob DeGrom's there, I, for one, would for sure go Jacob DeGrom over Mike Trout. And maybe it brings up a bigger point. And I know you just mentioned that you're kind of down on Shane Bieber. And so I'm not that we're down on Shane Bieber.
But just relative. But
We're not relative to the cost and where he's going. I'm not sure you or I are like just completely adamant on spending a top 10 pick on Shane Bieber. So would you go DeGrom over Trout, or would you just still go Trout?
Yeah, I don't know. I was talking with Brian Vogel about this. I mean, I think that's a real decision point you may have to make. I think I definitely am going Cole over Trout in that case, because I saw an online championship the other day. So I guess I just think Cole would have been pushed up in a main. But I did see an online championship where Cole fell to 10. And there, I mean, that's just crazy. I don't know how you're passing on him at that point. So, all right.
I think maybe for me, even though we both do love Trout, if DeGrom is there, I think the better build and roster construction would just simply to be go DeGrom or even Bieber.
Yeah. One of these years, DeGrom is so freaking good. He's got to win baseball games, right? I mean,
look, I don't like to project wins. He's going to win fucking games, and plenty of them this year.
Yeah.
That team is going to be really fun to watch. I'm excited. I love when new ownership comes in and they act as if they're a fan and they want to make their team better. And that is exactly what's going on over there. So kudos to the Bronx side, or not the Bronx. What are they? Brooklyn. They're the Brooklyn guys.
Yeah.
Okay. So yeah, that just kind of goes to show you, we're always going to be put in uncomfortable situations, but I think that it comes to be, you know, vital to understand, to premeditate what type of uncomfortable situations are you willing to put yourself in. And if you do, you know, those hitters are following, it is enticing to start Trout and Harper, but maybe it would be wiser to go to Grom and Harper and then kind of, you know, build from there and start that way. So it's going to be, it's, man, where does Mike Trout go in main events, live main events? He might go at the turn. He might, you could, and not that I would do this, but what if you were team 15 and Christian Yelich and Mike Trout are sitting there?
Like, what?
I know.
It's crazy.
It could happen, man. I wouldn't be shocked. Giolito, Darvish, Bauer, even Bueller, Castillo, all first round picks, dude. All of them. And that's obviously including Cole, DeGrom, Bieber. You're going to see some really, really yellow painted roads.
Yeah.
All right. Enough of that. Okay. I want to dive into a couple of things that were mentioned on my Twitter feed. I've spoke about the amount of exposure that I currently have to Brandon Lau and our friend in the community. We've already mentioned him, Dave McDonald. You can follow him on Twitter and I recommend you do so. His Twitter is @runDMCD. And he was just curious to know why I love Brandon Lau so much. And then the other question that he had that I posted was I had a laughing kind of gif of people drafting DJ LeMahieu over Corey Seager. So we're going to dive into those two things and then end with a quick Twitter poll question. So first, since we've touched on DJ LeMahieu versus Corey Seager, I wanted to ask you real quick before I go on my rant. Their ADPs are really similar, 35 for DJ, 39 for Seager. And the min and max are just, you know, a little here and there. But since DJ LeMahieu signed on January 15th, that ADP has dipped just a few spots. So he is getting pushed up a little bit more. And for the most part, any draft I'm in, I am seeing him go pretty much mid to early or early to mid third round. And now I'm starting to see Corey Seager go late third round to early fourth. That was what prompted me to tweet that out. Where do you stand on both players and which do you prefer? At equal cost.
So I think with DJ, what you're drafting is batting average insurance, ultimately, right? I mean, the guy I think is one of the best hitters in baseball. I don't think there's any discounting that. I think what confuses me on this one is I think DJ will score a lot of runs, but I think Corey Seager is going to have he's not going to have probably DJ's average, but I think he's going to have significantly more pop and significantly more RBIs. So it feels like we're buying into, look, DJ's won a batting title now in both leagues. He's clearly figured something out with his swing. I think everybody's also a little bit surprised just given some of the advanced metrics. I don't think he's going to return the same pop that everybody thinks he is, but maybe he'll outperform those metrics yet again. I feel like for the cost, Seager's the smarter play. Now, the only other thing I can think of is the fact that DJ is eligible at so many different positions, and maybe that's giving him a little bit of a bump. But I think you got to be careful about that, too, because there's a lot of people that are multi-position eligible this year. Doesn't mean it's something that you should ignore, but I don't know that it's as much of a unicorn as it used to be. I think there's a lot of people that are eligible at a lot of different positions. So that's the only way I can rationalize it, Matthew, but I don't know that it's the right move.
So I completely agree when you want to look on, you know, starting to scratch the surface here. Batting average, I'm going to be more lenient when kind of giving a fake projection or just an analysis on these guys. I'll be fair and go, okay, DJ LeMahieu finishes with, you know, 10 points higher in batting average. Corey Seager goes 290. DJ LeMahieu goes 300. Okay, DJ LeMahieu by a tiny margin. Then when you look at runs, I'm due to DJ LeMahieu leading off in a good lineup, good ballpark, really shitty division when it comes to pitching. I'm going to give the edge to DJ LeMahieu in runs, but I'm only going to give that edge 10 to 15 runs. That's pretty good. That's a little bit more than a margin, slight margin, but it's not too much, right? It's not just massive enough for me to be like, okay, wow, he's a huge run contributor over Corey Seager, because Corey Seager is definitely going to score his fair share of runs in the Los Angeles Dodgers lineup. So I consider those, you know, close to a wash as well. And then when you get into the speed and stolen bases, DJ LeMahieu might get a handful more than Corey Seager. So over the last 2 years, from 2019 to 2020, DJ LeMahieu had, I believe, 8 stolen bases and Corey Seager had 2. ATC Projections, which is ran by our friend Ariel Cohen. It's an aggregate projection system, and he has DJ LeMahieu projected for 8 stolen bases and Corey Seager projected for 3 stolen bases. Let's say that happens. Okay, so DJ LeMahieu gets 5 stolen bases more, a handful more, minimal. Now when we jump into the actual bat and what the players do when hitting the ball, it is a completely different story. Seager showed mutant pop in 2020, and that was with a 278 ISO supported by a 55.4% hard hit rate, according to StatCast. Seager's barrel rate jumped to 15.8%, while DJ LeMahieu's barrel rate was 2.9%. Sink that in real quick. 15.8% barrel rate to a 2.9% barrel rate. Launch angles. Corey Seager, 11.9. DJ LeMahieu, 2.3. Seager barreled up 28 balls in 52 games. DJ had 5 barrels in 50 games. Seager's power and the RBIs are going to be extremely, extremely higher than DJ LeMahieu. Seager will hit second, maybe even sometimes third in the Dodgers lineup, providing that massive ceiling for RBI potential. DJ LeMahieu will not be. He will be leading off. He will not have that RBI potential, especially trying to hit runners in when, you know, guys at the bottom of the lineup come up. Or are on base, I'm sorry. Then it comes down to the home run rates and everything. Just what is DJ LeMahieu giving you, you know, in a marginally different area than Corey Seager? And I don't think he is anywhere. Stolen bases, batting average, and even runs. But then when you count in the other two categories with home runs and RBI, Corey Seager could legitimately hit 20 more home runs than DJ LeMahieu this year. I said it, 20 more home runs than DJ LeMahieu this year. Corey Seager can also have 20 plus more RBI than DJ LeMahieu this year. That is significant. And for them to be going that close in ADP is fucking insane to me. So that is why I tweeted that. And that is why I am pro Corey Seager over DJ LeMahieu. And especially, Matt, when you put in the points of, you mentioned the position eligibility for DJ LeMahieu, first, second, third. That's all gravy. But yeah, that shortened season, weird things did happen. And there are a lot of guys that are coming in with position eligibility. And and I think the NFBC, I'm not sure what they're setting their games amount played this year, but it could be even smaller than it was in 2019 when we last had a full season. So I think even more players are going to crop up with more position eligibility as the season goes on. So for that to move the needle for me, it simply isn't enough. Even in a draft champions where you do want to kind of overweigh the position flexibility a little bit more, I just can't buy it. I really, really cannot buy it. Look, Corey Seager is a way better hitter than DJ LeMahieu. Corey Seager has been healthy the last couple of seasons. I don't want to hear about his Tommy John surgery from fucking 3 or 4 years ago, or the back, you know, strain that he had 3 years ago. He hasn't had anything crop up in a while. And dude, MVP upside. Gimme. Easy money. Easy fucking money, dude. Confident in that. I'm confident in that.
Yeah. The only quibble I have is I think that LeMahieu probably has a little bit more of a superior average than 10 points, but honestly, they're
really, really though. Okay, so here's my one rebuttal to that. DJ LeMahieu's BABIP last year was 370 something, and Corey Seager's was 309, and they're like
I agree. Come on, I just look at when I look at batting averages in their careers. You know, Corey Seager in his count 2020 as well. 308, 295, 267, 307. I think DJ LeMahieu has three seasons in the last five at 327 or higher, and it could be luck-driven, too.
Look at the Babbitts.
Yeah, I just at some point, I think we have to probably he's going to be an outperformer. But yeah, I don't think – I still am not saying that it's worth the difference, and it certainly is not worth the difference in ADP. I don't get it, and I think the biggest mistake people are going to make is if they draft DJ LeMahieu as the 26th home run hitter from 2019, you're going to be really disappointed, in my opinion. So
the last time DJ LeMahieu, which was 2018 hitting in Coors Field as his home park, and had a BABIP close to 300, which is kind of what you want it to be right around, right? That's kind of the average, yeah. Is a little over 300, I should say. It was in 2018, and his batting average was 276.
Yep.
I don't know. With the launch angle and how much he barrels up the ball and all of that, we've discussed all of that. But seeing the maturity, the maturation, and the growth of Corey Seager, he's the development and everything we saw was very, very real.
Yeah.
I hope the people that are not drafting him right, I guess, fuck, don't listen to me. Ignore what I'm saying. Give them to me. I'll take them all day. you know what I mean? And if you're really confident and you are listening to this of DJ LeMahieu versus Corey Seager, my DMs are open. You can slide in and we can place a friendly wager on DJ LeMahieu versus
Board
Corey Seager.
I'm baby. Very confident. Board bets.
All day. Yeah. I put my money where my mouth is. That's the thing with me. I don't give a fuck. Let's go into Brandon Lau. Before we go into Brandon Lau, though, I want your opinion, because I'm starting. It's becoming well known that I'm in on this guy, and people are wanting to know why. Dave was wanting to know why, and other people have been DMing me saying, "Hey, what's with the exposure?" And I've also said that he could be the number one second baseman overall at the end of the year, and so. That was kind of a hot take. Mm-hmm. Just before I go into him, I'm curious to know, where are you at on him?
So I like Brandon Lau. I could see a path to him being the top second baseman. I can get behind that. I think there's some risk in the profile. There's a huge strikeout rate that's paired with a lot of pop, a great walk rate. He's got a power speed combo that's pretty tasty. So I like him a lot. Don't get me wrong. I think there's a lot of room for upside potential. When I look at guys, I mean, because essentially, right, Brandon Lau has had 118 plate appearances with the Rays in 2018, 327 in 2019, and then obviously we had the truncated season with COVID-19 last year. So he's really got about a season's worth of at-bats, a full season, maybe slightly more than that, right? And so I think when I look at Brandon Lau, what I see, and you look at Derek Carty's the bat X projection, 252 average, which feels a little bit low, 29 homers, 80 runs, 80 stolen base, or 80 runs, 80 RBIs, 6 stolen bases. I think the power is real. Honestly, 6 stolen bases feels a little bit light, although it is interesting when you look at his minor league numbers. He didn't steal 10 in any more than one stop, but he clearly appears, and the Rays like to run, that there's 10-plus stolen base upside potential. The only thing that concerns me, in almost all of his stops, Matthew, across the board, he had a very, very high strikeout rate, some lower than others, but 20 plus in multiple stops, 34.6% strikeout rate, which is pretty hefty in 2019. So I like him. I'm not willing to bet that he'll be the number one overall second baseman, nor do you have to pay that price. That's not what you're saying either. But I could see a path where he gets there, certainly. So now I'll give the floor back to you.
Okay, I'm excited here. We're going to start with context and division. We're going to keep it simple at first, and then we'll open up the hood and kind of get into some of that stuff. So he's going to hit second, and he's going to be sandwiched in between Austin Meadows and Randy Arozarena. Those are the only threes that I am projecting to play every day for that team. Now, when I say every day, put that in context, there will be a day of rest, but you can pretty much plan on those guys being your 1-2-3 hitters in that lineup this year for the whole year. That is what I'm banking on, and I'm pretty confident in that. Last year, we saw that. We saw Lowe play 56 out of 60 games. So that makes me look at the projections. And then I look at the bat X, the bat, ATC. The projected games is almost 30 less than a full season. The plate appearances are sub 600. And then you look at the projections themselves, and you see 29 home runs, 27 home runs, 160 plus, 170 in the counting stats with a 250 plus batting average. Now, if the projections themselves, those are already pretty eye-popping to me, but then most people don't even notice that the games and plate appearances are quite low. Now, we can't just bank ourselves on projections and say those projections are correct. Look at that. However, I do put some of my process or a lot of my process into these projection systems. And when looking at that, I like to think of or try and understand the team context and the playing time involved. I am completely confident that he plays 145-plus games, 150-plus games, and gets to 600 to 650-plus plate appearances. When doing that, you then have to add more to everything we're already looking at. Okay, so that's a lazy approach to some of those things. But then we look at walk rate. It jumped to 11.2%. Over 10% is amazing, especially with somebody that's striking out 25% of the time. So sure, he's aggressive, but he can also see his pitches. The ISO of 285 is just, it's ridiculous. That's just, if you don't know, ISO is just basically talking about their true power, and anything above 200 is already pretty fucking elite. 285 is absurd. The ISO before that was 243 in 2019, and that was as an age 24 to 25 season. The barrel rate in 2019 was 14.1%, and in 2020 jumped to 17.5%, which was 98th percentile in the league. The home run per fly ball rate has just continuously gone up. Last year, it was 23.7%, but in 2018, it was 18.8%. In 2019, it was 21.8%. So you see a continuous rise in home run per fly ball rate, which is also a positive. Rays like to run. They finished with the sixth most stolen bases in 2020 and the eighth most stolen bases in 2019. He only has a 65th percentile speed metric, according to Baseball Savant, when looking at StatCast. However, he is projected all across the board for a little more than a handful of stolen bases. So six stolen bases is what I'm looking at here. I wouldn't be shocked if he maybe even did pitch into a total of 10. I'm not banking on that, but 5 to 6 stolen bases is fine with me. He was 90th percentile in ex-WOBA. All of that, with where he's being drafted, is just a no-brainer for me. Now, I want to look at some other simpler things before we close this out. Another second baseman that is being drafted shortly ahead of him, and I'm not even going to talk about Ozzie Albies. It's been well documented how I feel about him. It's been well documented how I feel about DJ LeMahieu. And it's also been well documented how I feel about Kevin Biggio. If you're uncertain of how I feel about those guys, please go to my Twitter and I'm sure you'll find it. I haven't discussed Whit Merrifield. We're going to ignore him for now. Going down to Keston Hira, who is the second baseman going shortly before Brandon Lau. I like everything, you know, on the outside looking at him as well. I think that the upside is there. I think the counting stats and the home run and a little bit of speed, that's all fine. However, when we look at things in a simpler format, I like to call it the KISS method. Keep it simple, stupid. Let's keep things simple and just look at that. Is the NL Central pitching as a whole better than the AL East pitching? I'd say yes. How about the NL Central parks as a whole compared to the AL East parks? I'd say it favors pitchers much more in the NL Central. Now, I'm going to name off every single projected, and this is according to Roster Resource, which I do not put a lot of my money or thought into, but these rotations outside of the Rays, and even including the Rays, but the Rays are, they don't matter because that's where Lau plays. These rotations, I'm just going to name off every single projected starting pitcher for the NL or the AL East. Hyunjin Ryu, Robbie Ray, Nate Pearson, Tanner Roark, Ross Stripling, John Means, Alex Cobb, Keegan Aiken, Dean Kramer, Bruce Zimmerman, Nate Eovaldi, Eduardo Rodriguez, Garrett Richards, Martin Perez, Nick Pivetta, Garrett Cole, he's good, Corey Kluber, Jameson Taillon, Jordan Montgomery, and Domingo Harmon. Now, outside of Garrett Cole, and when Hyunjin Ryu is feeling good, what are we doing here? What hitters, why are we not talking about just stacking nothing but AL East hitters? I think that this is going to be a huge conversation at the end of the year when you look at these numbers, at all the Blue Jays numbers, and all of the Boston Red Sox offensive numbers, and the Yankees offensive numbers, and the Tampa Bay Rays offensive numbers. They're going to be fucking astronomical. And people are just going to completely dismiss all of that.
Well, and not to go too far down a rabbit trail, because it's not the point that you're making, but the reality is, I think like the Red Sox are a pretty sneaky roster to own. I know they're going to be terrible. I think they lose 90 games, but I think they're going to be in some slow pitch softball games. And I think this furthers the point that you're making is the pitching in the division sucks. And I think there's, Matthew, would you say a better than likely chance that the Blue Jays are in Dunedin, Florida, which is a bandbox?
That's correct.
Camden is an offensive, you know, haven.
AL East Coors.
Yeah. I mean, and then you've got...
Oh, and then add Yankee Stadium to his left-handed bat and 98th percentile right. fucking yeah. barrel rate.
I mean, I hadn't thought about it that way, so I think it's funny that you brought it up this way.
He's going to play 9 games at Yankee Stadium this year. Like, okay. I know that's small, but okay, let's do small samples. What did Gleyber Torres do against the Baltimore Orioles in 2019? Yeah, Brandon Lau is about to do that to every fucking divisional opponent that he faces. And on top of that, I didn't even get into the splits, and I don't have any of that pulled up, but we can even dive into splits for a left-handed hitter. Last year was small sample size, had a better batting average against lefties. He had a 300 batting average against left-handed hitters. His WRC plus was 206. His ISO was 420 against lefties. I know it's small, but when looking at left-handed hitters that are hitting in a prime spot in the lineup and don't have nasty splits, and he's young, he's going to be coming into his 26, 27 season. What are we doing here?
Yeah.
And I'm not even the biggest Statcast nerd. All the Statcast people should be the ones pumping this dude up, not me.
Well,
add his abilities, yeah. where he's hitting in the lineup every single day, sandwiched with Austin Meadows and Randy Arozarena until Austin Meadows gets hurt, knock on wood. That's, dude, yeah. goal, Jerry, it's goal.
To me, I think.
Gimme, number one second baseman. I'm here for it, planting my flag.
I think that we've got, I think you want to target, conversely, Matthew, I think you want to target pitchers in the NL Central because those offenses are terrible. And I think you're right. I think in this one we want to target hitters because there's going to be some crazy run scoring games in this one. So I like it. I like that you got a bold prediction here. Let's see how it plays out.
What I know you got to run off real quick. One last thing. We ran a Twitter poll and it's pretty adamant. It was just basically asking which outfielder do you prefer? Starling Marte, his ADP is 46. Randy Arozarena, 57. They could be going in the same round or about a half round later than each other. Where are you at?
So I think the sample size for Arozarena does make me a little nervous. I mean, him being a former Cardinal, I think a lot of people saw he could have a path to stardom and he could be a really good player. So I don't know that it's necessarily there yet. Obviously, he hasn't done it, but he was magnificent. The watch out for me on Arozarena is just that he mashes fastballs and he really struggles with off speed. So, but he's got time to work on that. I totally get it. To me, though, Marte doesn't have anywhere near the upside potential that Arozarena has. He does not have the power by any stretch of the imagination. So to me, I'm probably taking Arozarena. I'm probably not going to own a whole lot of either one. Like I mentioned briefly earlier, I see a path to value in some late round outfielders. So I'm probably not going to be the biggest guy on them, but if I'm picking between the two of those, it's Randy A for me.
I was hoping you were going to go Starling Marte. I thought you were going to bring out your old boomer self and go Starling.
I mean, I am a boomer. I am old.
Yeah, you are. You are my boomer. And I'm going to have to agree with you. We're drafting Starling Marte for stolen bases, right? That's where we're at. We're drafting him for stolen bases and a steady Eddie batting average. He's not going to kill you there. We like that. Hitting at the top of the lineup, solid runs as well. Three cat contributor. Is that fair?
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Okay. In reality, right? Okay. Is Randy going to run? Run, Randy, run.
Yeah.
Run,
I think so.
Randy,
yeah.
Run. Fuck yeah. Fuck yeah. He's going to run, dude. He's going to run. Okay. And then the power. The power is incontroversial, right? Randy is just going to hit a plethora of more home runs than Starling. I think that's not even, I think Randy probably hit more home runs in the playoffs than Starling did all fucking year. But yeah. we're not gonna do that. We're not doing that today. And then when it comes to RBI, Randy's going to be hitting third with more power with Austin Meadows and Brandon Lau in front of him. Starling Marte is going to be leading off with whoever the Marlins are going to decide to hit second and third. Great. We just mentioned the AL East pitching. The NL East pitching is insane. It is extremely difficult, and the parks aren't as favorable. I don't know. I guess maybe I'm just a lot of people have been disagreeing with some of the stuff that I've been saying lately, and I actually think that I like it. I think that me saying things that others disagree with and I'm quite confident in, it could make for a great season or a terrible season. We don't know yet, but I'm very confident in Randy Arozarena over Starling Marte. And I know that sounds insane. Like Matt Williams said, sure, I'm going to take the guy that has 3,000 plus plate appearances over the guy, or however many plate appearances he has, over the guy that has, you know, 100 or whatever. So I get it. I get it. But okay, let's get the fuck out of here. Next week we will be back, and I think that you and I, we are going to be bringing on somebody that's going to be joining our team. We'll get into that a little bit later next week on Twitter. We're still working the kinks out on that, but you and I, Matt, we will be back together regardless. And moving forward, we're going to be doing at least one episode a week. I know that we had a little time off due to the holidays and then some scheduling issues between you and I, but you know, that's part of the gig here. What's going on with you? Do you have anything going on at Number Fire? And I'll get into what we're going to be doing at FTN. Yep.
Nothing yet. We're still kind of mapping out our content, which is coming up soon. I think the biggest thing, Matthew, as you dive into kind of what's next for us is, you know, podcast topics. I think we like to be resources for the people. So, you know, we've seen a lot of really good stuff with different teams, team previews, positional previews. I'm actually recording a Cardinals team preview over at Friends with Fantasy Benefits with Justin Mason's team. And Randy Haynes. I'm doing that tomorrow night. But if you've got interesting topics, this one kind of came organically to Matthew and I, and they're fun to dive in this way. It's fun for me and Matthew to talk about strategy and think about some different things. So if you've got ideas, please, you know, hit us up on Twitter. Let us know what your ideas are. We'd love to incorporate them.
Yeah, absolutely. And well said. So we're going to be working on and planning on having our season-long FTN Fantasy Baseball subscription/package available and ready for you guys. In mid-February, likely a week after the Super Bowl ends, and we're going to be having my rankings. We'll have all of our rankings and tiers. So my rankings and tiers, your rankings and tiers, Big John, Johnny Hurricane at MLB Moving Averages rankings and tiers, along with Brock, Brock and who's the other guy? Oh, my FTN Fabcast co-host, Chris Meany. So everybody's going to be putting together their own rankings and tiers. So each one will have a little bit a different little spritz to it, and then we'll have team previews including each roster, projected lineups, rotations. All of that will come with the NFBC ADP. We're going to have selecting a breakout and a bust for each team going at their current cost, and we're going to break that down per team, per division, and then we'll also have all of our articles starting to come up here pretty soon, just anything that's going to be essential for your draft prep in general. And then once the season kicks off, I will be doing the weekly Fab article. So please stay tuned at ftnfantasy.com. If there's anything that you want to read over there right now in regards to MLB, all of our work will be free for now until we release all of that goodness that I just mentioned. And that will be coming into a package/subscription shortly. So I look forward to all of it. It's a lot of work, but we've been grinding and putting together some things. I'm nervous about my projections this year. I had a lot of fun with them last year, but I think that there's going to be a lot of tinkering to be done.
Yeah.
I like the human component of mine. I cheat and steal and take all the nerds and their robotic, you know, formulas and all of their projection systems and basically throw it into mine and then put my own brain and my own hand, mind, physical, human, you know, touch on it.
Right.
That's what I get out of mine. So that'll all be available at ftnfantasy.com.
Awesome. Yeah, we're looking forward to it.
Well, I love talking to you, my dude. It's been too long. Let's start ramping this up and let's get on the waves, you know, once a week and potentially twice. Awesome. Thank you guys so much.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of the FTN Fantasy Baseball Podcast with the two Matts. Please rate, subscribe, and review the podcast, and we hope you listen again soon.